Okay, is this working, everybody? Yeah, fantastic. Sorry for the slight delay. We're just waiting for the technical side to get sorted out. But thank you very much for coming to my talk. My name's Annie Machon, and I'm going to be doing a talk tonight for about 45 minutes called Das Leben der Anderen. Now, you can probably work out that I'm not German, that I'm very, very British. So that's the extent of my German language skills you've just heard tonight, Das Leben der Anderen. So I do apologise for that. And this despite the fact that I actually moved to this marvellous country. I escaped from the UK last year in order to escape the encroaching fascist regime. It's getting that bad in the UK, so I came to Germany. Anyway. So tonight I've got about 45 minutes just to talk a bit about my experience working with British intelligence, which is always a bit of an oxymoron. But also to look at what it is like to live under a police state, what we're actually beginning to face in many of our so-called Western democracies. So I'd like to start with a bit of the spy stuff, just to give you a sense of what being surveyed, what being watched, what being followed can be like. And then we'll go on to the more sort of generic, taking from the personal story, the sort of macro political issues that we can draw from it. My background is working for an organisation in the UK called MI5, which is the UK Domestic Security Service. Now, when they went to meetings, they used to shorten it down to UKSS. And then some bright spark realised that with the German history, it might not be such a good thing to call themselves. So in the UK, we have three agencies. We have MI5 working within the country. We have MI6 working outside the country. They're the sort of James Bond fringe of the intelligence community. And we also have the listening post, which is called the Government Communications Headquarters, which works very, very closely indeed with the NSA in the USA. So I work for MI5. MI5 has been around for about 100 years. This is a sort of, you know, spook agency that spies on its citizens. It started off as a counter-espionage agency, and for the first 80 years of its life, didn't officially exist. So until 1989, nobody could ask questions about it. Nobody was allowed to discuss it in Parliament. Nobody could even know how much money was spent on the spies. They could get away pretty much with whatever they wanted. A very famous whistleblower in the 1980s called Peter Wright, who wrote a book called Spycatcher, said that MI5 could bug and burgle its way around London with impunity. And this was sort of the glory days of spying. We can do what we want. However, there were a series of scandals in the 1980s, and they were put on a legal footing in 1989 with the Security Service Act. And after that, they had to obey the law. I mean, if they wanted to do something which would be illegal for us to do, like break and enter into someone's home to plant a bug, or listen to their telephones, or intercept their mail, they needed to get prior written permission from their political master, the Home Secretary. MI6 and GCHQ followed suit in 1994 with the Intelligence Services Act. Now, I say this because I think I could not have conceived of working for an organisation that just could do what it wanted and broke the law. But I was recruited after it was put on a legal footing. And they went to great pains to explain that they had to, you know, follow the law, and they had to get written permission before they did anything that might be a bit dubious. They also told me, at that time, in the early 1990s, that they were changing their approach. They were stopping looking so much at political activists, at espionage, and they were going to be moving towards terrorism-style targets. They wanted a new generation of officer who could work on fast-paced investigations, who could gather evidence, who could put a terrorist suspect on trial in front of a jury. It seems like a very quaint, old-fashioned idea now, doesn't it, rather than just taking them off to Bagram Air Base and shooting them. Anyway, I was recruited and worked there for 6 years, and in that time I met my ex-partner, as well as ex-colleague, a man called David Shaler. And we saw so many things going wrong that we decided we didn't want to work for an organisation like that. I mean, we saw files being held illegally on UK citizens, including a number of government ministers who became part of the Labour government. We saw mistakes made that meant that IRA bombs, the provisional IRA, of course, was the big terrorist threat in the 1990s. So we saw IRA bombs going off on British mainland streets and killing innocent people. They could and should have been prevented. We also saw illegal phone taps and also two cases of false flag terrorism. This is a sort of slightly strange concept, but the first one was in 1994, where a car bomb exploded outside the Israeli embassy in London, and two Palestinians were arrested, charged, and convicted of conspiring to cause that attack. and they both received 20 years in prison each as a sentence. And yet it turned out that MI5 knew that they were innocent. There was a document written by a senior MI5 officer who had seen all the evidence and all the intelligence, which you can't necessarily put into a court case, and his view was that the Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad, had bombed their own embassy. Now, on the internet, you think, mad conspiracy theory. But as I said, this was the formal assessment of the lead investigator in MI5. And that came out during the whistleblowing years, and yet those two people are still rotting in prison to this day. But that's further down the line of the story. But the case that made David Shaler and I quit was an assassination attempt. And it was an illegal assassination attempt funded by MI6, our James Bonds. Now, I say illegal because, as I mentioned, they were put on a legal footing in 1994 with the Intelligence Services Act, which meant if they wanted to do something illegal, they had to get prior written permission from their political master. In this case, they didn't, so it's illegal under UK law, as well as being highly reckless, highly unethical, in a very volatile part of the world. Basically, what happened is that there was a volunteer, a Libyan military intelligence officer, who was codenamed Tunworth, walked into the British embassy in Tunis and said, "Can I speak to the local spy, please?" Because all our spies work under diplomatic cover. It's very easy to find them. And he said he had a cunning plan. He had a group of Islamic extremists who wanted to try and topple Gaddafi, but they needed help. They needed funding and organization from MI6, so would MI6 help them? And lo and behold, they did. They gave them over $100,000 over a period of months to buy the kit, to buy the explosives, the guns, to try and stage this coup. Now, Shaler at the time was the head of the Libyan section in MI5, and he was briefed officially all the way through as this plot developed. But he didn't think they'd go ahead and do it. I mean, MI6 like to pose as being James Bond, but they're not terribly effective. But early 1996, he saw all these intelligence reports coming across his desk, and they indicated that there had been an attack against Gaddafi. Basically, he'd been traveling back from a Libyan People's Congress in Sirte, and an explosion had occurred underneath one of the cars in his cavalcade. People in the car were killed. More people were killed in the ensuing security shootout. Manifestly, Gaddafi survived. He's the new best friend of all our Western leaders. So the plot went wrong. And as I mentioned, it was also illegal under UK law. And he was very concerned when he saw this. He went to his opposite number in MI6, whose James Bond number was PT-16B, remember it? And he said, you know, what was this? And the guy in MI6 apparently turned round and said triumphantly, "Yes, we did it. That was our guy." Until Shaler pointed out, "Well, actually, you didn't do it, did you? Gaddafi's still walking around." But anyway, for MI6, that was a bit of a triumph. They'd managed to do something, even if they got it wrong. That's spies for you. Anyway, we saw this and we realised that we didn't want to work for organisations, for the intelligence community that got involved in conducting terrorism. We'd signed up to try and stop it. Now, under UK law again, if you see crimes committed by the spies when you're working there and you want to report those crimes, there is no one you can take those reports to legally. You will be prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act if you go even to the police or if you go to your MP. You just can't say anything ever to anyone. But we decided it was worth the risk. We decided to resign. We went to the newspapers because we wanted to ensure there was publicity around these cases in order to push for an inquiry into the crimes of the spies. And then we fled the country. We ended up literally going on the run around Europe for a month. This was way back in 1997. And the story broke and was massive at the time. And we ended up on the run, and then we had to live in hiding in a tiny little French farmhouse for about a year. And then they tried to extradite Shaler from France, and they failed, but he spent 4 months in prison there. And another 2 years in Paris, went back to the UK voluntarily, and he was put on trial, of course, under the Official Secrets Act, and convicted. And it was a sort of fake sham trial. And it was interesting as well watching how the press reacted to all this information coming out, because it became very apparent how much control the media, the spies have over the media, how they can plant stories, how they can spin stories. So that was quite a sort of salutary lesson for us in terms of learning how these people operate behind the scenes. So in terms of what it's like to live in a police state, going through those years, we did, of course, live under surveillance. We had to get used to being in our lives where we couldn't take for granted the fact we could have a private telephone conversation, where we couldn't speak securely in our own flat in case it was bugged. So if we wanted to discuss something more sensitive, we would always go outside. Where we didn't know if we could trust our friends. I mean, we know some of them, they admitted to us, were put under pressure from the police to report back about what we were up to. Where we saw myself, friends, family, arrested on trumped-up charges. Where Shayla could just be disappeared, where he was arrested and taken away, put in prison, and nobody could trace him for a few days. All these are aspects of what it would be like to live under a police state. Now, of course, our case was slightly extreme because we'd worked for the spies, we'd blown the whistle, we'd gone on the run. I mean, you know, that wouldn't happen in a day-to-day scenario, would it? Of course not. You know, we live in democracies, we're okay. Well, I'm sure many of you are aware and very angry about it, but, you know, post 9/11, with this endless war on terror, we are now in a scenario where our civil liberties are being decimated, where there is an encroaching surveillance society, where we're all beginning to look like we're living under proto-police states. So I really just want to spend the bulk of this talk looking at exactly what that entails and what it means and hopefully what some of us can do about it. So, I mean, what's the basic concept that we're talking about? Many of us are very angry at what has happened since 9/11 in terms of our civil liberties going, of our privacy being invaded, of all these laws hemming us in. But what exactly are we discussing when we shout out the slogans, totalitarian, police state, Nazis, fascism, pigs, which we do in the UK to the police? What do we mean? Well, I think the basic core concept is totalitarianism as the sort of end game. This means literally total 360-degree control of society in terms of not only what we as citizens are allowed to do, but also what we ingest as information and what we think because of that, as in media propaganda. And that is the aim of totalitarianism. And governments, of course, in the past have been able to do this. I mean, you know, what happened in the Soviet Union, the Sov bloc, and I suppose the apotheosis of police state happened right here in Eastern Germany, where we had the Stasi with total lockdown on its citizens. I mean, I think the estimate is that there were 16 million citizens within Eastern Germany, of which at least 200,000 were working as Stasi informers. And, you know, again, you can't conceive of being able to speak freely, discuss your political ideas freely, of being able to trust your neighbours or even your family. And this is where I got the title, of course, for this talk, Das Leben der Anderen, which is an amazing film of the interplay between the watchers and the watched, and what it's like to be the watcher and also to be the watched. So if anyone hasn't seen that film, I do recommend it. So we're looking at this whole concept of total control. And if anyone says, well, governments are there, you know, they're there to serve us, they're our representatives, they're benign, we're a democracy. I'm sorry, there is always that will to power. Governments will always take as much power and control as they can, and it's up to us to draw the line and say, no, this is the line, enough is enough. We are not going to give away any more of our civil liberties. So we have the concept of this control, and then the police state, the tactics of a police state, of a surveillance society, are the way of controlling. That's the sort of method of controlling the country. So it's a pretty fragile state. How does this sort of idea of totalitarianism manifest itself? And I think if we look back through history, if we look at what happened in East Germany, in the Soviet Union, and other communist or totalitarian regimes, there are a number of key areas that the totalitarians need to gain control of. First of all, the political arena, and the judiciary, and the economic, and the media, and also of the people themselves, how they police us. So I just want to skip through some of those areas, and let's see how far down the line we are. Well, certainly in the UK, which is why I left, and I think America is pretty far down that line too. Germany, of course, has a rock-solid constitution, or better, so there is a relative degree of safety here at the moment. But even looking at the political, many people feel very turned off by mainstream politics. I mean, turnouts for elections is very low. We feel that we don't have a voice. They're not going to listen to us. But what's actually going on? I mean, even the politicians who rock the boat, who ask the difficult questions, who are the awkward squad, are now being victimized to a certain extent. They're being singled out. I mean, we had a case in the UK a couple of years ago where a Conservative MP called Damian Green was arrested. He was arrested because he'd been taking leaked information from the Home Office about immigration figures. The government had been lying, of course. He exposed those lies. He embarrassed the government. And they arrested him. But not only did they arrest him, they went into his home and his office in Parliament and ripped them apart in a counter-terrorism-style search. Just took everything. So again, you know, that point actually made some of our other MPs sit up and say, well, you know, we're living in a police state. My God, what happened? Well, you should know, mate. You're the ones who actually passed those laws in the first place. Do you think they don't apply to MPs? Well, obviously they do. But there have been other cases as well. There's a politician in the Netherlands called Geert Wilders, quite a notorious politician speaking out against Islam, who was invited to the UK last year to do a talk at the House of Lords, hardly a bastion of radicalism and subversion. And he was turned back at the airport as he tried to come into the country the first time. They banned an elected Dutch MP from visiting the UK at the invitation of Parliament because they didn't like what he was saying. And we have another AUKUS squad member, an MP called George Galloway in the UK, who tried to go to Canada a couple of years ago and was deported because they didn't want him speaking out against the illegal wars in the Middle East. So they do get the ones that question, the ones that speak out about issues that are unpopular, do get victimised. But that doesn't mean that most of our MPs, for example, in the UK, think they're not above the law. They do. We've had, I don't know how many of you are aware of the expenses scandal that's been rocking the UK establishment over the last year or so now, where these elected representatives have just been milking the system, taking huge amounts of money out of the public purse to feather their own nests, to pay for their homes, to pay for things like toothbrushes. And even our ex-Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, got caught because her husband was downloading porn and then charging it to the public purse. Anyway, she got unelected a couple of weeks ago, which was good news for everybody. So they're quite shameless about it. But it can be worse than that as well. I mean, again, in the Netherlands, you have a sitting Prime Minister, Balkenende, who lives in a country where a panel of judges have come together and passed a ruling saying, in their view, the Iraq war is illegal. Balkenende took the Netherlands into the Iraq war. Balkenende is still caretaker prime minister, and Balkenende is not being prosecuted in The Hague, despite the fact the courts in his country have said what he did was illegal, effectively. So they do get away with it. So the awkward squad, the difficult MPs, the ones who ask the interesting questions, can be victimised. Most of them are in the system to take out of it what they can get, and they think they're above the law. We need to hold them to account. But actually, they're still pretty powerless. Again, taking us into the illegal war in Iraq, they had no notion of what the real intelligence case was. They had no notion of what the case for war was based on, which was lies. I mean, the UK, we were told that Saddam Hussein was trying to acquire uranium from Niger to make weapons of mass destruction, which was based on false intelligence coming out of MI6. We were told that weapons of mass destruction could be used against British interests within 45 minutes, based on a lie. And we were told that the case for war was based on fresh intelligence that kept coming in. And that was a lie too. It was based on research which had been on the internet for 12 years. It was an old PhD thesis. So all these lies were used to ramp up a case for what was an illegal war. Many people, I can't think of anyone I know who disagrees with that now. And yet, they voted for it. They knew no better. They didn't have the information to do their job as our democratic representatives. So that's the political system, certainly from my experience in my country. What else do we have, though? As I said, there's five key areas. The judiciary, the courts, the people who are supposed to uphold our civil liberties and protect our rights and see that justice is done. Where are we there? Well, in the UK, we have already entered a full-on Kafkaesque nightmare. And I use that word very accurately in this case. People can be interned, they can be put in prison on the say-so of an intelligence officer. They have been since the war on terror was announced. They're not allowed to see what evidence is against them or what intelligence. They're not allowed to know what they are accused of, so they can't defend themselves. That is Kafkaesque. But it's worse than that as well, because, of course, terror suspects now can be snatched and kidnapped. extraordinarily rendered is the euphemism they've been using for years. They are flown off to torture camps around the world. And if they're lucky, they wash up, or they have washed up, in Guantanamo Bay. There's one very famous victim of extraordinary rendition in the UK called Mozan Beg, who was in Pakistan helping to build a hospital. He was there with his wife and small child, and he was snatched one night, hooded, cuffed, in front of his screaming family, taken off to Bagram Air Base, where he was tortured for 18 months. And he said, after that, they took me to Guantanamo Bay, and I was relieved to get there because the conditions were so much better. This is a British citizen just being kidnapped and disappearing. Didn't see his family for 3 years. And the spies, of course, it now appears, have been complicit in these torture sessions. British spies, people I might have worked with. I mean, how they can get involved in that sort of behaviour. Beggars belief. So we have all that. We have also a very unusual extradition treaty in the UK. It's one-sided. It's with the USA. I believe the Netherlands has similar. I don't know if Germany does. Where the USA can ask for a British citizen to put on trial, take them over to the States, put them on trial for breaking a law in Britain. They don't have to submit any evidence to the British court. They just say, we want so-and-so, send them over. Now, people have been sent. There's a very famous case coming to fruition at the moment. A hacker called Gary Kinnan. I don't know how many of you have heard of him. Famously in 2002, and this guy is not a super hacker. You know, he's a bit of a geek. He was looking for evidence of UFOs and little green men on the Pentagon system. And he was using this PC and a dial-up modem in his bedroom in North London. So, you know, hardly the stuff of cyber terrorism nightmares. Anyway, 2002, he goes into the Pentagon system. He said there was no security. He didn't even need a pass, he just got in. And he had a look round and left a very polite message saying, you may want to upgrade your security, guys. And that was that. And he was caught. And the British said, well, we could try you under the Misuse of Computers Act 1990, but we're not going to. But even if we were going to put you on trial and you were convicted, the most you would do would be community service. So the British caught him and didn't prosecute him. The year later, though, the Americans said, we have this war on terror. We want an extradition treaty with you, UK. So they passed a new law called the Extradition Act 2003, which was the one I just described, where the Americans can say, we want you, you have to come over here for trial. And they retroactively applied that to Gary McKinnon and said, we want this hacker. He's caused millions of pounds worth of damage and, you know, found God knows what in our systems. And the Brits caved in. They said, yeah, have him. So he's been fighting through appeal courts ever since. And the Labour government, the old government, was going to just hand him over. If he were sent back to the US, they are threatening to put him in a maximum security prison for 60 years. This for a case which wasn't prosecuted in the UK. And the Labour government said, yep, British citizen, yep, have him. Now, of course, we have a new Tory-type government, Conservative government, who in the past have said they wouldn't extradite Gary when they're in opposition. So let's hope they stick to their word. So that's our judiciary for you. Great place. Economic, of course, is pretty much controlled now. I don't think anyone after the crash of 2008 has any illusions that we have a say over what is done financially and globally in corporate world. Bear in mind that Mussolini's quote about fascism, his quote was, the closest definition you can get to fascism would be the merger of the state and the corporate. So you end up with something like corporatism. Now, I would suggest we're absolutely there, apart from, I wouldn't call it a merger, I'd call it a hostile takeover. The corporations have taken over our nation states. We have these sort of supranational organizations of people who are unaccountable, like the Bilderberg Organization, like the Trilateral Commission, the Carlyle Group. These business interests have locked down what can happen to the business world. And we see, you know, these sort of predatory financial hits on countries like Greece. We see the asset stripping, you know, the public sector is being sold off. I mean, I don't know how many of you have read the Naomi Klein book, Shock Doctrine, but that was quite an eye-opener for me. And we also see, of course, that other big corporations can just ignore the democratic will of countries, like, again, the Netherlands, where they have a new government policy saying they should use open source in government and public sphere in life. And Microsoft, which is, I believe, a multiply convicted monopolist under EU law and has been fined record amounts of money, just carries on lobbying the government and saying, no, we've got to have a software lockdown. Don't go with these nutty hacker crowd, you know, who want to use Linux and things. And people who protest against these sort of measures, anti-globalization protesters, environmental protesters, hackers, are now being described in the UK and the US as domestic extremists. This is one step away from terrorists. You know, there's been a scandal in the UK where the police are investigating people for domestic extremism because they protest their rights. You know, they have photographs of the most wanted people they take to demonstrations now. It's been quite widely reported, actually. It's a scandal. It's a scandal. So here we go. Political, judiciary, economic. What have we got left? Media and, of course, what happens to us. And with the media, again, we see an amalgamation of ownership. There are very few big mega corporations that now own most of the media outlets in the world. Of course, I'm talking mainstream media here. We have a very efficient spin machine coming out of our governments and our corporations. We have a system of journalism where the people working in the mainstream media have to produce twice as much material in half the time as they did 20 years ago. They can't do proper investigative journalism anymore. They can't get to the root of what's going on. They just have time to process the press releases that come out. So, you know, again, it's a bit of a nightmare. It's a bit of a nightmare. But in the UK as well, we have all these laws that hedge the media, hedge journalists around, telling them what they can and can't report. I mean, some have been prosecuted under terrorism laws. Some have been prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. Some are prosecuted under the libel laws because the UK is the libel capital of the world. So if you write something libelous in the US and it's US print book, but one copy is sold over Amazon in the UK secondhand, then the author can be prosecuted in the UK for libeling someone. And it's happened a couple of times already. It's quite obscene. But we also have the malign influence of the spin doctors, the intelligence agencies as well, who invite these journalists into their sort of secret charmed circle and say, look, we'll give you stories if you write what we tell you. But if you don't get the material and you can't write a story and you won't have a job. So it's a sort of carrot and stick scenario where they can control the output of intelligence correspondence, defence correspondence, and that sort of thing. There's also even a section in MI6 called Information Operations, or IOPS, it's shortened down to, which is there deliberately to run stories, fake stories, in the media and to manipulate stories. So the spies do that. So I think media is getting quite shut down too. And I know it's very easy for us to say, well, you know, we all get information off the internet now. You know, nobody reads newspapers. Nobody believes what they see on Fox News or CNN or BBC anymore, do they? But unfortunately, vast swathes of the population out there still do. You know, we take it for granted we use the internet. But believe me, if it ain't on TV, it ain't real for most people. So we can't dismiss that. You know, it is very effective propaganda. And in the case of channels like Fox News, it's hate-filled, vicious. It's just bile. It's disgusting. So where are we? We've still got the people side. What's happening to us? How do they actually use police state tactics to try and suppress us, to try and control us as a population? Well, as I said, last year I left the UK before the prison gates clanged shut and came to Germany, because I see this country as a place where at least there is a strong constitution, which is being upheld despite challenges in the courts of this country. In the UK, we don't have that. We have had law after law after law being passed since 9/11 to take away any of our civil liberties, many of our civil liberties. And it has a really bad reputation now as a sort of prison island. I mean, for example, in the past, when I was working for MI5, if you wanted to tap someone's phone, you had to get a warrant from the Home Office, the sort of Interior Ministry, in order to do it legally. But only a few organisations could do that. I mean, obviously they could lie and get it anyway, but things like the spies, tax, customs, military intelligence, the police, those were the organisations for serious, serious cases, supposedly. Now we have that law that governs the interception of our communications, and it's called the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000, RIPA. And under this law, 800 public bodies across the UK can intercept our communications. I mean, we are talking everything down to your local town council can use what were supposed to be terrorism laws. And they do. There, you know, been scandal after scandal. I mean, they've been spying on fishermen to see if they're taking too many of their quota. They've been spying on people to see if they live near the school they want to send their children to. And yet they said, trust us, this is just to stop the evil terrorists when it came through. We can't protest freely outside our Houses of Parliament. We have to get written permission from the police. We don't even have total control over our own homes now. They have something called a Civil Contingency Act, which means that if a minister wants to sign a state of emergency for 30 days, they can stop us having political meetings, they can quarantine us, and they can even seize our homes and demolish them in the name of national security, and then not pay any compensation. And this law just went through. It wasn't reported in the media, pushed through Parliament, not a whisper of opposition. We have also things like terrorist suspects can be held by the police without charge for 28 days. That's a month in a police cell while they question you. And the Labour government before wanted to take it up to 90 days. It's 3 months in prison. And it just goes on. We have the most widespread CCTV network, closed circuit television, of anywhere, I think, in the world. They reckon there's over 4 million of the publicly owned CCTV cameras on British streets, not to mention all the security cameras for businesses. So everywhere you go in London, for example, they reckon if you go out from your home to your work and back again, you will be photographed at least 500 times that day. They also, you know, they're in all hotels, they're in all public buildings, even in the lavatories of businesses in the city, they have CCTV in the cubicles. So there is no privacy anymore. It's in your workspace. So it just gets worse and worse and worse. I mean, the latest thing I saw was that some of the police forces in the UK are suggesting that they start using military-style drones to fly over their areas to spy on the citizens to make sure they're not committing a crime. This is going to be it come in the next couple of years. Kent Police Force, I think, is going to pilot scheme it. So we are going to be watched from on high, and we don't have any idea. So it is pretty much a lockdown in the UK, and people are sort of aware of it, but they don't know what to do. But we are very much in the position of a sort of endemic blanket electronic surveillance society. That's not to mention all the databases they're beginning to use as well. They wanted us to have ID cards with all our biometric information on them. They have now a travel database like the USA. So if you want to fly into the UK, you have to give all your information, where you're going to stay, what you're coming for, how you're paying, before you can buy your airline ticket or train ticket or whatever. So it is becoming a bit of a shut-off country. And this, as I said, is all done in the name of the war on terror. Our governments keep telling us that the world changed on 9/11. We now live in a state where we have to worry about evil terrorists. Well, actually, the concept of terrorism is much more linked to state terrorism. This is where the whole idea comes from. I mean, it started in the French Revolution back in 1792. They had a phase where they could denounce fellow citizens. They could be taken off, guillotined, weren't allowed a fair trial. And that period of French history was actually called, is still called, the Terror. And that's where the phrase comes from. State terrorism, where they create a sort of climate of fear, of panic, so they can terrorize us, either by using violence or by threatening violence or by talking up the threat of violence from terrorist cells. And yet in the UK, as I said, we had this period of the 1970s to the 1990s where we were under real terrorist threat from the Provisional IRA. They were a very effective, very sophisticated terrorist organisation. They were putting bombs down at will across the UK. But we didn't need all these counter-terrorism measures that we have today. What's the difference? I mean, far greater threat then of realistically getting blown up in London than now from Al-Qaeda. So we're just sort of sliding in unthinkingly to this sort of police state-type surveillance. And I'm with Benjamin Franklin on this one. Those who give up their liberties for security deserve neither. So we need to sort of push back a bit on this one, I think. I found a very interesting quote about Amnesty International. I just want to read it, a very short one, about the escalation of this concept of state terror, where they foster this fear level. And they say, in its annual Global Human Rights Report, Amnesty International has extensively documented the escalation of state terror. It has identified the main forms of state terror as arbitrary detention, unfair trial, torture, political murder, or extrajudicial execution. Now, that's all going on. It's all being done, either here in Europe or in the Middle East. So we have pretty much reached that stage, I think. So what can we do? I mean, yes, we have this sort of endemic state surveillance, certainly in the UK and the US, and governments will try and push it out as much as they can. It's in their interest to have that control, that will to power. It's just part of the nature of the beast. We also have this wholesale erosion of our basic human rights, our civil liberties, and we have these sort of corrupted institutions, the benchmark of what makes a police state. So what can we do? I mean, we're getting very close, certainly in the UK, to living under that sort of environment. Well, I think the hacker community can play such a valuable role in trying to push back some of these measures. I mean, organisations like WikiLeaks are fab. I just wish they had existed 10 years earlier when, you know, I was involved in whistleblowing on the part of the secret state. But stuff like the recent video they released of the US military helicopter shooting up innocent civilians in Afghanistan, I think it was, and it was decrypted and it was leaked and it was put out there for public consumption. And that was great, the fact that they had the capacity to decrypt it and to spread it around the planet. I mean, it's interesting, though, watching the sort of response afterwards. I mean, everyone was sort of looking at the technicalities of it and actually what did they do and, you know, what happened and how long did it take and the technicalities of the hack. What we need to remember in a case like that is not the detail. It's the bigger picture, the fact that the Pentagon had lied about this attack for years, barefacedly to the public, denied all knowledge, denied all justice to the families of the victims as well by doing so. So always, always, when stuff like this comes out, it's gold dust for activism. But always, always keep our eye on the bigger picture. So I think, you know, there's some great stuff coming out of the hacker community as well, breaking RFID chips and things like that, and how to get around biometric details on your passport. It's fab. But always take that step back. The technology is fantastic, but why is it important? What is the social context as well? Keep your eye on that bigger picture. So this is my experience. This is my view of where we're going as well. And I have to say, on the note of hackers, I'm going to do a little bit of shameless plugging for some friends of mine who are here this evening. It's an event coming up in the Netherlands in August, the 10th to 13th, and it's a conference called ETH Zero. And the tagline is, hackers save the planet, which is why I think it dovetails very nicely to the end of the talk. I always pronounce the word etho, because that's how I read it in my mind, because that's how I think of the hacker community. It's the ethos, the ethical approach to life is so important. But hackers save the planet, and yes, I think they will. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think officially we're supposed to be on a break now, but you know, if people want to ask questions or whatever, there's a mic up front if people want to come so it can be filmed as well. Or just shout it out and I can always repeat it. But thank you for that. Sorry, one at the back. Well, yeah, we have this strange sort of hybrid government now because we have this first past the post two-party system, which, and you can't really tell the difference between the two parties, so it's like a one-party state. So, yes, we have the Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron, and we have Nick Clegg, who's the head of the third party, the Liberal Democrats, as the Deputy Prime Minister. And the Liberal Democrats have been better on some of these issues, like anti-war. They all voted against the Iraq war, like the issues of civil liberty, like the issue of Gary McKinnon. So we can see that they, in order to give the Tories the majority, have cut deals on some of these issues. And the Tories as well are not stupid. The Conservatives, sorry. They're not stupid because they do know that angry Middle England is concerned about some of these civil issues, civil liberties issues as well. So, for example, our new Foreign Secretary, William Hague, recently said there will probably be an inquiry into the spy complicity in torture, which is great news. I mean, those bastards should be held to account. If they're there listening to someone screaming and feeding in questions, they should be in prison. And also, there has never been an inquiry into the bombings in London of 7/7, July 7th in 2005. And of course, the families always wanted an inquiry, and the Labour Party wouldn't give it to them, the Labour government. So they're now saying, yes, there will be an inquest, even though it's going to be held relatively in secret to spare the spies. So they are talking about the civil liberties issues. Whether they actually properly deliver is another matter, because I think opposition parties are always wonderful, aren't they? And as soon as they get a bit of power, they can be talked around. Yeah. No, so they're making the right noises, but let's give them a bit of time. Because, I mean, you know, when Labour came in 1997 after two decades of Tory government, everyone was like, yes, thank God, you know, no more financial corruption, they're going to be ethical foreign policy, blah, 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 which is what they promised. It's the most unethical foreign policy we've had in a long time in Britain. So, you know, we have to wait and see. I'm not holding my breath. Any other questions? Well, 9/11 is a sort of wonderful pretext, isn't it? The whole war on terror. I just think there is this basic drive to power. Once, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power will corrupt absolutely, is the old saying from the Romans. But yes, in terms of defining police states, there's always sort of, well, do they have the will and the technicality, the capability to do it? And in the past, most of the countries with the capability to do it had constitutions that were pretty solid, like the states or like most Western democracies, even if they had the electronic capability to do it. But now, of course, post 9/11 with the war on terror, they have the will to spy as much as they can as well. And the capability, of course, has just exploded over the last couple of decades with the internet. So I think it's a sort of perfect storm of different issues. Plus, of course, we have this sort of more globalized economic scenario and all these different groupings. As I said, like the Trilateral Commission, you know, the think tanks and Chatham House and Bilderberg and things, where all these people meet and sort of, well, what works for you? You know, what can we try in our country? But it's interesting. But yeah, I think it's just the perfect storm. It's an opportunity. And I'm sure most of them don't think they're being maligned. They just think, well, we know best, you know, our intentions are pure. Perhaps they are. But if you have these powers in position and then someone who does have bad intentions gets elected, the whole country is screwed. Any other questions? Yeah.
Do you have information about the state of resistance against these developments?
Perhaps we should start calling ourselves the resistance. That'd be great. the state of resistance in the UK. There is a lot of anger amongst activist circles because they're being victimized, they're being beaten up on demonstrations, they are being spied on indirectly, not just by the official spies, but by this sort of mushrooming private spy sector, organizations, you know, Blackwater, Kroll, Aegis, Diligence, those sort of things. So there's that side of it. And there's also, as I said, sort of the middle classes are getting a bit concerned because they're not being listened to about the war, and they don't like CCTV cameras everywhere, and they don't like being told what they can put in their rubbish bins and things. So things like that are beginning to annoy people. But we're not getting the joined-up thinking. You know, it's very single issue because people don't feel that engaging in the mainstream political debate tends to get you anywhere. So they get very passionate and believe very strongly about these single issues. But we do need to sort of drag them all together and say, well, what's the baseline? And that's, I hope, what I was trying to do tonight in terms of all these moves towards a sort of controlled state affect all these different areas. And if we think about it in those terms, then perhaps we will find each campaign and grouping has more in common, and we can work a bit better together. So, probably time for one, two more questions. Anything else? Right, I'll take these two, yeah. Yeah, I did. We wrote a book back in 2003, which came out in my name. And I had to submit it for clearance to MI5, otherwise I would have been prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. And they sat on it for a year and a half, of course, and only took out very few bits. They asked me to remove certain sentences, and I just left them blacked out in the book. I wanted to show I'd been censored. And one of the things they asked me to remove was this very, very secret surveillance technique nobody's ever heard of in this room, CCTV. I don't know why. Anyway, so that's blacked out too. If you ever find a copy of the book, there's little four letters. Oh God, I've just broken the Official Secrets Act again. So yeah, that came out, and then it just wasn't picked up or reviewed anywhere. And spy books, whistleblower books, always get a lot of news coverage, and this didn't. And some of our journalist friends just said, look, you know, we've been told we're not allowed to review this book. They want everyone to ignore it. It's called Spies, Lies and Whistleblowers, and it's sort of, I think, available on BitTorrent somewhere. So there's one other gentleman over here. God, that's the big question. I think knowing what we know about false flag terrorism is just a historic reality. I mean, this is used time and time and time again by intelligence agencies and government to gain political advantage of some description or another. You know, all kinds of countries use it. I mean, there was the case of Alexander Litvinenko, the Russian KGB colonel who was poisoned with polonium-210 in London, who was actually a whistleblower who blew the flag on false flag terrorism in Russia, which was the bombing of some apartment blocks in Moscow in 1999, which was blamed on Chechen rebels and used as the excuse for the Chechen war. But it was actually carried out by the modern version of the KGB, the FSB. So it happens everywhere. You know, Mossad does it, MI6 does it, the KGB does it, the CIA does it. It's perfectly standard. It's naive to think they wouldn't use it. So it's a big question. And I think any thinking person should at least ask and have a look at the evidence, because you know, you can't just dismiss something like that, particularly when you look at how it's been misused as the pretext for the war on terror and the wars in the Middle East and the erosion of our freedoms. And, you know, I have to say there are a lot of professionals out there, particularly in science and architects and engineers and pilots and people like that, saying, look, there's evidence discounting the official version. Even the chairs of the 9/11 Truth Commission, the official report, have now said they were set up to fail. So I'm not saying anything one way or the other, but with my background of whistleblowing on those subjects, I would urge anyone, just please have a look and have a think about it for yourself. But again, it's something the mainstream media would never dream of covering, I suppose, so I don't know. One very quick one, and then I think we need to wrap up because they need the room. Yeah, it sounds like some sort of evil James Bond thing, doesn't it? No, they're not run by, but certainly there is a sort of elite in most countries where you get revolving doors between political people, the media, big business, arms businesses, and the intelligence agencies, military. So a lot of these people are linked or know each other through different families or from school networks or university networks. And I think there is a sort of natural urge to guard their own, you know, their own interests as a grouping. So, yes, they have a sort of informal influence, which is much more powerful, I think, than their apparent formal official influence. But, yes, if you have intelligence agencies operating without any oversight, any real proper oversight from the governments, they do what they want, and they can lie to those governments to influence those governments' new laws and policies, and that's what they do. So, in terms of the leverage they have, yeah, it's very, very powerful. Okay, well, I think we're pretty much out of time. The next speaker's on in 5 minutes, but thank you very much for sitting through all that. And